You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So we are here for the AI and Earthly Futures discussion, and my notices have just gone away on my phone, so I'm very sorry. There we go. So this talk is being recorded, and our volunteer team worked really hard during this festival to make sure that you could access Greenbelt all year round through our recorded talks. If you feel maybe after this panel discussion that, oh, there was that one thing that this one person said and I'm not entirely sure if I heard them right, or you just want to relive the magic all over again, you can pre-order some talks at the G store, which is over by the Glade stage. Or if you're feeling a bit fancy, why not surprise yourself, bit of like talks roulette, and get the all talks bundle. Very exciting. You never know what you need until you get it. Or if you want to be vintage, you can get talks from all the years gone by. So they are accessible at the G store. So without further ado, thank you for joining us today in the Pagoda. I am going to hand over to William Temple Foundation's Chris Baker. This is AI in Earthly Futures.
Thank you very much, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Brilliant. Good afternoon. Welcome. And it's lovely to see you all. Thank you for taking the time and space to discuss and hear about this really important topic. My name is Chris Baker. I'm director of the William Temple Foundation, and I'm also professor of religion, belief and public life at Goldsmiths. The William Temple Foundation is a public theology think tank named after Archbishop William Temple, who coined the phrase the welfare state and was one of the co-architects of the post-war welfare state. So we tried to do what he did, which was to hold open a public space where we can talk about the future of society, the future of our culture, and the future of religion and belief in that. So that's exactly what we're going to do this afternoon. We're very grateful to Greenbelt for allowing us to curate this series of events looking at AI and all things digital and the post-digital, and trying to work out what that means for us as a society, for us as a planet, and indeed for us as citizens, and you know, particularly if we belong to, we would count ourselves as religious or non-religious in that context. And the purpose of this afternoon really, I mean, there are no answers to the questions that we're raising about earthly futures and AI. But I think if we can, at the very least, just give you some new ideas, give you some discussion points, give you some follow-up, then hopefully you'll carry on thinking about it until hopefully we may meet again at next year's Greenbelt. So to help us with that task, I've got a brilliant, fantastic panel of experts with me, some of whom you may have already heard in the context of what's been going on. So on my right, I've got Professor Beth Singler, who's Assistant Professor of Religion and Digital Religion at the University of Zurich and author of Religion and AI, An Introduction. That book is coming out very shortly. On my far left, I've got Kester Bruin, author of Godlike, and head of communications at the Institute for the Future of Work. And both Beth and Kester have had seminars where they've talked about their work. And then on my immediate left, I've got Professor Maggie Savin-Baden, who's research professor at Oxford University and commissioning editor of a 20-book series on the metaverse. So please welcome your panel. So there is a temptation with some of these things to go very kind of broad brush and scattergun, and I hope we don't do that. I think what we're going to try and do today is focus on issues of power and agency. So where is the power lying in this debate? Where is the agency lying in this debate? Who has agency and maybe who doesn't? But the first question I'm going to ask each of my panelists is, in respect of this idea of AI and earthly futures, what is the narrative of our destiny, and who do we think controls it? How are you feeling about the future? A very simple and straightforward question. How are you feeling about the future? And Maggie, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you. I would like to say that I'm feeling really worried about the future. I think at the moment we're in a situation where there's too much capitalist control. There's too much surveillance. We've got virtual humans and robots and AI, and we really don't know who's controlling what.
Thank you. Kester?
I'm feeling a little bit more, I want to say a bit more hopeful, and particularly around issues to do with regulation and work. We've got a new government, and that government is hungry to listen to things we hope. I was talking to Lord Tim Clement Jones, who's a Liberal Democrat, one of the leads in the House of Lords, who's kind of working a lot on AI regulation. One of the things in my job is I help lead the all-party parliamentary group into the future of work. And, you know, if we can focus on workplace impact, we can actually help people to have a fairer future of better work in the context of AI and automation. That's not about rejection of these technologies. It's about understanding how they can be integrated better for us. That's something that we've always had to do in different industrial revolutions. It took us too long in the past. If you think about the ones, you know, industrial revolutions 400 years ago and the long time it took to respond to rehumanizing in that context, we've got to do that more quickly. But I'm hopeful that with kind of agile international regulation, we might be able to do that. That doesn't mean I'm confident, but I want to be hopeful.
Thanks, Kester. So Maggie's quite worried. Kester's cautiously optimistic. Beth, where do you sit on this?
So I suspect the question about feelings is to push me beyond my anthropologist role, where usually I like to skip and say, I'm agnostic. It could be really good. It could be really bad. But I think we should pay attention to these narratives. So okay, you know, push me past that. I will still adopt a paraphrase of William Gibson, who he said the future's already here. It's just unequally distributed. I will say the hopes, the fears, the good things, the bad things, they're already here. They're unequally distributed, which is wonderfully messy. And to slip back onto my anthropologist hat, the messiness is where the anthropologist lives, but it's hard to see beyond that collection of trees to see the wood sometimes. So yes, I'm agnostically worried sometimes and sometimes agnostically hopeful. That really doesn't help anything, does it?
No, I mean, I'm interested in this tension really between, you know, trying to rehumanize our society and the world of work in the context of what you were raising, Maggie, about, you know, surveillance and capitalism. Where do you see, how do you see those two things kind of working out? Do they counteract each other or are they, is it possible to have both?
I think when you start to look at things like the explosion of the metaverse, people think the metaverse is something new, and it's not. In many ways, the metaverse has been around since the 90s and the growth of virtual worlds. And I think what we have to recognise is that the new kinds of metaverse are imbued with capitalist principles, which I think we need to be really sceptical about. But we also need to see the values of it around things like the way it melds people and platforms and technologies and ways that are positive and are useful. But I think at the same time, we need to be really careful about virtual humans. I work in a world where people want to create digital copies of themselves to leave behind so that they are digitally immortal, which certainly in a faith-based community tends to be really problematic. I think the other thing in all of this is we need to look at the amount of surveillance that is going on and what we choose to give away and what we don't.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think very often technology promises one thing and it delivers another. So it's promising very much to deliver to you a sense of power and augmentation for each of us, and that's the great promise it holds out. But actually, it tends to be the other way around, that what we are delivering for technology is a lot of data going up to them to make them more powerful. So we need to be really careful about those flows, and particularly, you know, that surveillance idea. The Ring doorbell is a good example. You know, it's going to make you safe and feel secure. And almost everyone I know we've got one. It's kind of made them more anxious. But there's a heck of a lot of data about their activities going up to other companies to make them feel more powerful. So understanding where the power flows are, I think, is very, very important first step to understanding and being more reflective about our own technology use. that is one of the key things that we have to do, is to be more reflective. I said in my talk the other day, you know, the Amish get a pretty, actually no, the Amish get a quite good press, because remember The Witness? I mean, that was a kind of like Harrison Ford joins the Amish and then all the rest of it, a long time ago. But, you know, they at least make a decision about technology. They don't use zips, they use buttons. They still do up their clothes. This isn't about a rejection of technology. I am very, very pro-technology, but I'm also extremely pro-human. And at the moment, we get that equation a little bit wrong, in that the promise is always more technology, and that tends to be at the expense of human experience. That we've seen in past industrial revolutions, and as I say, in the past, we've not worked well enough to do that work of protection, and that's been really, really problematic. And trades unions, other kind of, you know, mid-level structures have had to arise over longer periods to try and help mediate that, but we've got to do that more quickly. And at the moment, that space has very much been evacuated by technology, those mid-level structures. AI is coming first for the managers. You know, in my work, I see that's it. It's coming into the HR systems, algorithmic decision-making. It comes for the managers, and that is a very, very problematic space. If all you see managers doing is making decisions about what workers are going to do, rather than seeing it about a values and a leadership modeling or a kind of servant thing that you're doing in order to help a workforce. So we've really got to be much more reflective about these technologies. That's not about rejecting them. It's about understanding that they are human made, and we can make a different future by taking some decisions around them.
Thank you, Kester, very much. So a spectrum of feelings there about the future, which I guess probably mirrors some of what you're thinking about in the audience. We'll come back to some of these themes that were raised, but I think what we want to try and get to now is this idea of this narrative of our destiny, and who do we think controls it? Where do we think the power lies in this debate? Who is shaping the debate? And you, Kester, you started to respond to that, so I'm going to come to you last, I think. Beth, I think you've got some interesting ideas around charismatic voices and all of this.
Yeah.
Who's pulling the strings? Who's got the power in this debate?
Start naming names. But I think I actually just quickly want to pick up on something that Kester said, which is related, is that he says technology is doing and technology is promising. And I think if we're going to talk about charisma, we need to think about the charisma of the technology that convinces us. Because if you saw my talk, I talked very briefly about how we have the technology and then our perception of it around it, and the different elements like anthropomorphism, our tendency to describe AI in particular as a thing doing something that has its own agency. And I agree there's a certain level of agency in a network of actors that's going on with AI. But the more we say AI is doing, the more we forget the humans that Kester obviously also mentioned are doing and choosing. So the charismatic authorities I'm talking about also include AI, where people start to see it as more than just a technology, that it influences their lives. And Kester's book is brilliant on the images of godlike AI. And I've done work as well on how people would say they feel blessed by the algorithm because they don't understand the intricacies of how the algorithm is intentionally designed and created by humans, that they can only possibly speculate that, oh, I've had a good day on YouTube and my video has been seen lots of times. I've been blessed by the algorithm. The gods have chosen me. And that kind of charisma is very hard to push back against. And the charisma of figures like Elon Musk, I don't particularly find him personally charismatic, but the way in which he influences certain sectors of our community and our culture is very worrying. That he's selling us a story about AI being a thing that's going to do a thing. No, it's humans who are going to do a thing. That transhumanist vision he has of escaping Earth, that secular dominionism that says we can burn up the Earth and get off to Mars, it's fine, is all wrapped up in our vision of AI. And we need to be very, very clear on what stories we're being told.
Thank you. Interesting there about this idea of the secular. Kester, have you got any thoughts on this idea of charismatic spiritual of AI?
I think the idea of the charism and AI as some, you know, you could almost see it as like a spiritual gift. It's going to augment your humanity in ways that it's going to take us beyond this idea of human and fill in that which we've kind of lost in the fall, as it were. And you can see a lot of those ideas about spiritual gifts as being things that augment us. And technology presents itself in that kind of charism way. It's a gift that we are blessed with by some higher power. But in fact, very often that flows exactly the other way, that the gift is going up to them. We are serving them. You know, the reason why Facebook is free is because we are the ones generating content for it. You know, it is only there so that we feed its data so that it can know more about us and sell us stuff. And that's before we've got into the kind of AI generated content. So understanding in terms of which way these gifts are going and which ways these flows of information are going, the promise is that we are being made more powerful, more knowledgeable, being, you know, by being blessed with more information. In fact, it's mostly the other way. And that is a kind of promise of capitalism. It's been for a long time a promise of religion, that religions have very often exerted powers of control by saying, you are getting this, whereas in fact, the power is going the other way. And that kind of understanding of those power flows is something we keep repeatedly having to do each time there is a new kind of, you know, overarching meta-narrative that presents itself as coming to save us, bless us, all of that. We've got to do that same thing again. Now we've got this new thing of AI presenting that narrative.
Maggie?
I think in all of this, I agree with both comments here, but I think one of the big things that troubles me is that we don't really understand what AI is. We talk about it in very, very general terms. And one of the things I think we have to do is to be responsible. What do we mean by AI? It isn't one general thing. It's algorithms. It's facial recognition software. It's surveillance capitalism. It's chatbots. It's robots. It's a whole pile of different things. So rather than using the term AI as some bland term, I think we need to unpack that, particularly when it comes to things like facial recognition software and the damage that that does. And I don't know about you, but I don't know where most of the facial recognition software is in my town. I know that I can buy a jumper that stops people spotting me because of the patterns on it. But it's also the way the algorithms are used and the danger that presents to different people in different areas of society in terms of those algorithms. So I think we just need to be really mindful of what it is that we are referring to and using when we talk about the different forms of AI.
So we've got these themes of, you know, the power being, we're being seduced by the charisma of AI and the digital, but we're also held back by ignorance about what is going on. I mean, Beth, have you got any further thoughts about either of those two ideas?
Well, I just want to follow up on Maggie's point. I absolutely agree. Specificity in what we're talking about is really important. And even going back to the origin of the term in the 1950s, they had a very specific idea, a very specific model of intelligence. But I think it's also very important, as I say, to recognize the shapes around the technology. People's conceptions of them are part of the story, the influence of science fiction in particular, that gives us an idea that, of course, well, yeah, one day we'll have robots in our homes because we've been thinking about them since the 1920s. So it's all there bundled up when someone says AI. Even the people who don't know what AI is, they're still getting images from the press at this stage. I mean, when I started in this field, there was lack of knowledge because it hadn't exploded into generative AI, but that's now the general conception that people are dealing with. So yeah, bringing in those sort of various narratives is very important.
Yeah, and very interesting on that kind of the origin of the term. And there's a kind of real split early on in that community. So I spoke in my talk about a guy called Doug Engelbart, who was head of the Human Center for Research of, it was the Stanford Research Institute and Human Augmentation. He preferred the term IA, Intelligence Augmentation, but others wanted the term Artificial Intelligence. And one of the kind of real pioneers of that movement, Marv Minsky, said to him, you know, the future is going to be amazing. We're going to have machines and they're going to be intelligent. And Engelbart turned around him and said, yes, but what are you going to do for the people? And I think that's an incredibly important difference there. He was saying, look, we shouldn't be focusing on making artificially intelligent autonomous machines. We should be focusing on what is best for us as people. And I think, you know, what Maggie was saying before we were speaking about in terms of this in the context of a climate crisis is unbelievably important. Like, we may be able to do magical things, but we're probably going to destroy ourselves in the process. So the terminology we use is super important, but keeping that human element very, very, very central.
So what do you think is disempowering us from raising these very critical questions about the way this whole debate is going?
I think you've said it already, Chris. It's critical questioning. My question is, why are we not asking more questions? Why are we not being more challenging? I speak at our church, and this morning I was put on for a double preach, and I asked somebody if they could take it over for me so I could come to Greenbelt. And they said, oh, what are you speaking about? I said, oh, artificial intelligence and earthy futures. And they said, oh, very nice. Well, actually, it's not very nice. And I think we need to be more critical. We need to take this stuff to our churches. We need to be critical. We need to think about the choices that we have. You know, I'm pleased. I'm looking around and I'm not seeing most people Googling us as we sit here on the stage. You know, we have choices about what we do with our technology, and we need to manage those choices.
There's no coverage though, I don't think.
Yeah.
There is. I have some.
Can we all have it? But I suppose what you're raising, Maggie, as well, is the question of responsibility. And there are these kind of, you know, these seductive narratives about, you know, us being significant and contributing, you know, having a much greater sense of importance than we actually have when it comes to these issues about who controls what. Is there something more that we should be doing in terms of our own personal responsibility around these issues, do you think?
Me?
Yes.
You're not going to ask Beth that one.
Beth can go first.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to add in on Maggie's point, the critical questioning, critical thinking is essential. We're not supporting that in our education systems. We're not supporting universities. Quick shout out to universities there. But I think also one of the issues that's obscuring what's going on is our tendency to get too excited about far future possibilities. And I've run workshops for religious leaders who have congregations of various different faiths. And they will much rather have an in-depth conversation about personhood and Imago Dei and other versions of that than get into what's happening right now for the people that they should be talking to. So that kind of excitement of the future can obscure the present. And when it comes to personal responsibility, just to get back to the actual question, I think we can draw red lines from both the personal and the public level. We can decide this far and no further. We can choose what we do and don't adopt. My personal example of this is that when I have two books coming this year, but one of the publishers sent me off to a stock image site, and I'd say about 90% of the images were generated by AI rather than humans. And I refused and said, I know an artist. She's already done amazing work on redesigning our ideas about what AI should be represented in art. I want to hire her. Money for a human. You can make those choices. There are choices that are being taken away from us, but the more we dissent and vocally and publicly dissent, we can say we don't want these things. The stereotype of the Luddite has to be pushed back against. There are people out there calling themselves neo-Luddites. There are people who are also very interested in calling for a pause on the development of AI. The concern there, though, is that sometimes that pause is only to really establish that AI is this big, exciting thing and that they should be the particular people to regulate it and control it. So we have to have the critical thinking as well on our dissent.
I was just going to come back a bit.
Yeah.
I think also it's the responsibility of what you do with your tech. There's a standing joke in our family that when my children were growing up, they're now 22 and 24, we gave them 10 minutes of screen time per day. I get worried when I see six-month-year-old babies in pushchairs on a cable car in Switzerland being given an iPhone to distract them. And I think that's a real worry, that we don't stop our young children from engaging with technology. We're not responsible enough to say, no, this is not okay.
As a former teacher, I'd also say a shout out to the whole thing of, you know, ban phones in schools is absolute nonsense, and I'm using a polite word there, because phones aren't really used in schools. It's parents who've got to be doing that, you know, really, really tough work. But just to kind of reflect a bit more on that, I was saying a bit on this in my talk, you know, every technology has this kind of double thing that it does. And if you think about a very simple technology of a hammer allows you to extend your reach into the world. It allows you to strengthen the impact that you can have. But the hammer reaches back into the heart and asks you questions about what you want to do with that extra power. And the more power a technology has in reaching out into the world, the more kind of rich the questions that it asks back into the heart. And with an incredibly powerful technologies like social media, we've seen that that has been hugely problematic, that we just weren't ready for the way that it would get back into that, which is why you saw in the early days of Twitter, people posting stuff and saying, whoa, that, you know, that's really racist. Oh no, I'm not a racist. Like, oh no, you are. It's just, it reached back into your heart and shone a light on something that maybe you weren't even there, ready to kind of admit yourself. And with AI, this incredibly powerful technology that allows us to reach out into the world, it must force us to actively ask those serious questions ourselves about what we are going to do. And the major problem is when I go into workplaces and talk to politicians and others, nobody is being trained to use this technology properly. People are just being given access to ChatGPT and say, oh, see what you can do. And what they tend to do is to use the French word, enshittification, of their labor and of people's work. And actually these technologies can do incredibly good things to release people from dull, dangerous, and dirty work. But currently, they are being used basically to substitute people's labor and get rid of people's jobs. And we cannot allow that future to happen. And we need to speak at a personal level and at a corporate level within churches and lobby our politicians to choose a different future, one that is going to be better for all of us. It is available to us. We've got to work hard to make that future the one that we choose.
Well, it'd be really good to, we're going to have 15 minutes at the end to hear your responses about issues like, well, what's responsibility look like to you in terms of this debate? And be really good to hear your thoughts and views on everything that's being said. But in terms of this kind of, kicking back, if you like, against the power, trying to make ourselves less disempowered in relation to the narrative of our destiny, it's critical thinking, personal responsibility, but then also the hard yards of political lobbying so that we get policies that do frame AI and digital in ways that, you know, do enhance human flourishing and planetary flourishing as a whole. So Kesti, you were beginning to talk about the future there. We've talked about how you're feeling about the current situation in terms of AI and the digital and the post-digital. Actually, Maggie, before we go on to talk about the last session, I hear this thing about post-digital quite a lot, and maybe you do as well. And I'm a bit confused because I still think, well, aren't we still living in the digital world? So I think you've written quite a lot with a mutual friend and colleague of ours who's unfortunately no longer with us, John Reeder. And one of the many books you've written on this whole topic is this idea of post-digital. Before you get on to the last question, I think it's quite important, maybe helpful definition, but what's post-digital mean to you?
It's a bit like AI, really. It's not one thing. Post-digital is the idea that is not we're after digital. It's the idea is that everything has merged together. So that instead of, we're here, we're with our phones, we live and work in a post-digital world. I don't think there is anywhere that is not digital. Whether you've got a smart fridge or a smartphone or whatever, everywhere is digital. So it's really the merging of AI and platforms and Google and ourselves and the possibility of sentience. It's the whole, as the word that Beth used, the messiness of our digital world that is post-digital.
Okay, any other definitions of post-digital from you two? No? No, that's good. Okay, so we're going to sort of start to think about the messiness of everything that we talked about. And I'd be quite interested to hear from our panel, how do we change, can we change the course of events? And can we imagine or even enact an alternative future or alternative futures? So I'd like the panel to begin to think about alternative futures and changing the narrative. Who'd like to go first?
I can speak up. Yeah, I mean, in my work, we kind of think of this at three levels. And you've got the kind of individual level, the kind of mid-level, firm level, the MISO level, whatever, and then the kind of systemic level. And I think at individual level, it's very important, as I've said, to take personal decisions about that. But also at that group level, you know, these size structures, and whether that's in a church or a trades union or in a workplace, to kind of have engaged voices thinking about, reflecting on technology adoption and the choices that are going to be made, that people come together to think about the impacts, go through processes of what those impacts are going to be, and make decisions about what technologies are going to be adopted. And we are developing tools that allow people to do that, algorithmic impact assessments and focusing on good work. And we know from the research that we've done, actually, that, you know, in a business context, if you do that, the outcomes are better for the business, but they're also better for workers who are more engaged, who are more skilled. You get better quality jobs at the end of it. It doesn't have to be all that poor stuff. Actually, there is a really good narrow path towards great AI that is good for everybody. But at that kind of system level, we've got to lobby people to do that. There's a particular opportunity now with a lot of new MPs who are hungry. MPs are terribly under-resourced. So gather together, ask them about stuff, feed them stuff. They're being currently fed by organizations like the Tony Blair Institute, who are hugely positive and optimistic about AI, particularly to do with efficiency in public services. I don't share that optimism, and we've got to do better to kind of think like, hold on a second, that kind of pushing of AI is being done by big data companies. We need to lobby your local representatives to make them think again about focusing on human experience and kind of human flourishing within that, rather than AI is the great thing that's going to be good for everything.
Thanks, Kester. Yep. Audience participation, very, very welcome. So what you're talking about is a kind of near future. You're not allowing yourself to go too far into the realms of what I know, Beth, you call speculative futures. Mm. And I guess when we're talking about this idea of what does the future hold, what's an alternative future look like, that's the tension, isn't it, between the near future and the speculative future, which is where all the Terminator robot, you know, movies reside and other things. So what's your sense of a possible alternative future?
So I don't necessarily want to outline my own vision of a future, but I think raising the Terminator is a really good point, and it reminds me that there is a moment when you choose to watch science fiction, usually. So you choose to buy the tickets or you choose to turn on the film. And we know from that point on, we're being told a story. In real life, we don't always recognize when we're being told a story. And some of those stories about AI are still very influenced by the science fiction. So you get this blur, this bleeding through of science fiction and science fact. And it goes back to critical thinking again. But if we can start to recognize the stories we're told, we can also start to change them. We can push them in particular directions. We can push back against the ones we don't like. So if we want a story of a happy ending and a happy future, then that's an aspect certainly that we need to think about.
So would you recommend, what does that mean? What does that look like in practice, do you think?
Well, you see the latest news story about the Terminator image on the story about AI and go, well, no, maybe the story itself is actually quite bland and we're being told that this is something to be scared of.
Would you have any recommendations for the kind of putting out counter narratives? So are we talking about movies? Are we talking about stories?
What absolutely. About? I mean, engaging with audiences when they know they're being told a story, you can tell them specific stories. So I made a series of short films that dealt both with the fictional elements, but also interviews with experts trying to weave those two things together. Unfortunately, one of them actually came out the same time as a much larger budget film about Slaughterbots. It was a short film about friendship and companionship in AI and questioning whether that was a good idea or not. But the hyped up example gets more attention. So the more these sorts of events happen where people can hear a different narrative, the more things can change.
Thank you. It'd be good to hear about your counter narratives, or the narratives of different narratives, different scenarios, different futures. Maggie, what are your thoughts about the future?
I remain worried. I think the thing that I have four views. I think we've got four lacks and a worry. So I think we've got a lack of understanding about social media and how we use it. I think we've got a lack of understanding about fake news and the impact that has on us. I think we've got a lack of understanding about how AI is being used to manage us. But I think my real worry is the whole impact of AI on our world. We're talking about earthly futures here, and AI is having an absolutely massive impact on our global situation. And I guess my only hope in this, maybe I'm stealing the ending of what I was going to say, but I think my only hope for AI in the future is that it will help to ruin the fossil fuel industry.
Loudest clap of the afternoon for that one. Well, before we get on to, I mean, I think you're raising the very obvious question about, so where is hope in the future, in these future scenarios? And I'm wondering whether, you know, we can begin to tease out that question. But one thing we haven't really talked about either yet, and maybe you could refer to this as you answer the hope, and I'm not necessarily putting the two things together, but we haven't really talked much about the role of religion or faith or spirituality in this whole agenda around our earthly narratives, destinies and that kind of thing. So, who'd like to go first on hope? And if you'd like to answer that question with regard to issues of faith, spirituality, belief, please throw that into the mix. They may not be, the two things may not go together, but I mean, I'm kind of assuming that they might. Who'd like to start?
Esther, yeah. I'm very happy to. I kind of talk, the last chapter of the book is really, what should we do and what's some practical things about that. If you've read my previous work, you'll know that part of that came out of a tradition called radical theology, which is a kind of deconstruction of the idea, particularly, this idea of the transcendent God and an understanding that within the Christian tradition, there's this beautiful celebration of the Eucharist where God dies and we become the body of Christ that is distributed out amongst us. And that sense of taking something that then dies and is distributed out amongst us, I think that radical theological understanding can be applied economically, politically, and technologically. And, you know, theology is wasted just on ideas of theology, basically, that it ought to have, the most radical theology ought to be working on economics. And I think very much these other grand narratives, these other meta-narratives, these other ideas of the big others, these huge systems that control our lives, even if we don't really see that, we need to also have rites and rituals where we put those to death and understand that process in the Eucharist where we become that distributed network together, not deferring to some higher transcendent other who is going to do all that great work for us, but understanding that beautiful gospel message of that death of God and then the redistribution whereby we become that network together. That, for me, is the most powerful thing we need to do with AI, is kind of break down this idea that it's this kind of global power thing up there and re-empower one another as nodes in networks that have agency, that have power, if we will just gather together into those places. We've been so broken apart and atomized by this promise of technology. We need to have a re-encounter culture where we learn to be one another together, learn through methods of trust and transparency, how we can have that political agency together as people together, and become that body once more, rather than thinking, oh, it's us and some kind of transcendent thing above. So there has to be a kind of radical theological understanding of AI for me. And that, for me, is like why Greenbelt should be talking about AI and theology together. and environmentally, because I think those things go absolutely together. As I say, you can read more about that in the book, and I'll be over.
That's a great plug for the book, Hester, and I shall be certainly reading it. I suppose with my public theology hat on, and maybe introducing a slight note of caution, not necessarily scepticism, but where are the public spaces where we can have these kind of debates?
Oh, they've been shut down. And you know, Maggie's absolutely right. Churches don't want to talk about AI because it's far too threatening. It's just not a space that I think people want to be talking about that. But also, people, you know, this is a book about AI, but it is probably the most, the most theological book I've written. I want people to return to theology rather than be scared of that. Oh, you know, we're going to be talking about God, you know, like the old turn of everything, don't do God. Absolutely, we've got to do God, because you may not believe in God, but you've got to believe in God-like structures. Because I can tell you what, Elon Musk does, and all the others do, they believe in having these huge narratives that have enormous power and influence over people. And our ability to critique them and understand them is a profoundly theological task. We've got to have that language of understanding systems that are bigger than all of us. So those public spaces must be reinvigorated. We've lost them. They've been evacuated because capital does not want us to have them.
Thank you. So curating public discourses, public conversations about this. This is what we try to do at the foundation, but I admit it's a major job to do. And I'd be very interested to hear whether any of you have got ideas about how we can break this discourse out of even semi-public spaces like Greenbelt and really infect, if you like, the mainstream discourse about how theological insights can inject a new realism into this debate. Maggie, where do you see hope?
I think I see hope in human beings. I've written a lot and done a few books too on virtual humans. I've also done one on artificial intelligence and death and dying. And interestingly, there are a lot of interesting conversations in death spaces, in death cafes, where I think we can take our discussions as well. It's raw and it's tough, but it's also important. So I think for me, the questions are, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be human and have a faith and to share that faith? And what does it mean to be not digitally tethered? How do we put aside the digital in face of becoming better and more effective human beings in this globe, on this globe?
Thank you. So rediscovering our humanity and becoming, you know, not being digitally tethered and rediscovering a faith, having a faith. Part of the beauty of this panel is it's interdisciplinary. So we've got two kind of theological voices on one side. Mm-hmm. Beth, you're very interdisciplinary. I know you're religious studies, but maybe not mm-hmm. theology. So what does hope look like from your maybe more anthropological perspective?
Yeah, you stole my line because I was going to say, I'm an anthropologist, so I don't have to answer this question. I just observe. No, it's not true. The observations that I have as an anthropologist, though, mean that I can look hopefully above some of the mess. We try very hard to extract ourselves from the mess and understand it. And I used the expression yesterday in my talk that anthropology is elegantly theorized gossip, which is not originally mine. I have it from a friend, but I think it's a very good way of summarizing it. So if the conversation, where is the hope? I'm seeing it in so many locations in religious spaces across faiths that when I started in this area back in 2016, more specifically on AI, but I was looking at digital things before then, people didn't know what to talk about. They didn't know even how to understand what AI was specifically doing in the technological sense. So to have a religious response to it, we're catching up still. Me as well. I'm always trying to understand what's going on with the technology and keeping up with the conversation online. And the conversation online, as much as we might wish to extract ourselves from the digital, you can't take apart the master's house without his tools. We connect and we communicate in online spaces, and that's where you see a lot of the religious responses now. And some of those are quite extreme. I gave examples yesterday of some of the extreme rejections, but there's more nuanced discussions as well through many faiths, and they're coming to terms with the fact that they can't just talk about the long-term view. They can't just get into the exciting things about personhood. They actually have to deal with the here and now. So I hope that's where the hope is.
Thank you. Well, we've come up to, we've just about got 15 minutes left. I'll invite my panelists just to offer one more thought, to summarise before we move to the end. But I'd like to really hand over the whole debate and discussion to you. So this is a chance for you to ask any questions, feedback, your own comments, whether you've agreed or disagreed with what's been said. So I think we've got a roving mic. Would anyone like to kick us off with a question? We've got one, two, three.
Just a bit of a preface before we start. Oh, I'm going to move away from that speaker. That we do value all opinions and views at Greenbelt, but this is a reminder, a question and answer session, not a statement and answer session. So if you could phrase your opinions in the most question-like way possible, that would be really appreciative. And also, we're trying to get a variety of views at Greenbelt. So if we don't choose you, we are very, we still appreciate your views, still have those conversations, but we're trying to get a variety of the room as possible. So I'm going to go straight to you.
Hello, I'll try and phrase this in terms of a question, but it should elicit some sort of response. One of the big problems I have with all of this is it reduces the humanity to the categories imposed by the computer. So AI, for example, it's not really artificial intelligence, it's an alternative intelligence. And what it is a lot less than human intelligence. So my question, this is the difficult bit I have here. I'm not quite sure what question to ask about this. I don't really know what question to ask about this. It's just I think, trying to frame the debate in terms of we are going along with a definition of intelligence, which is problematic in itself, and a definition of humanity that's problematic in itself, rather than going, oh, well, let's worry about AI, let's redefine what AI actually is, and we then can redefine our relationship to it. Would the panel have any views on that?
That's a brilliant question. Thank you.
Yeah, can I pop it? So there's a wonderful quote I love from someone called Robert Wilinski, who was around the early days of AI. And he says of the founding fathers of the Dartmouth College that they defined intelligence by what they could do. And they could prove theorems and play chess. So if AI could do that, then it was intelligent. And we get to a point now where the powers that decide what intelligence is are deciding what AI is. And they're model is very hierarchical and quite often with themselves at the top, and that includes also lower than them other human intelligences and other non-human other intelligences, so animal intelligences, all the way down to fungi. That's how they model their world. So if we're going to upturn that relationship and deal with definitions of AI, we have to start considering the intelligences already around us that don't map onto our more narrow version of it as well. So you can frame that in a post-human conversation, and that sometimes gets you into relation with transhumanists who already have more expansive views of where the lines of intelligence are going on or not. Or you can just say we need to look again at where we are situated in our environments and the cultures around us. So I absolutely agree. There's various different ways they could have defined what they were doing. I'm not sure alternative intelligence works perfectly. But these days, maybe we can also say artificial stupidity.
I'd just add to that. I've also written some fiction in my life as well. And people say to me, "No, do you think AI will ever write a great novel?" And a lot of people want to say no. And I say, yes, but there should only be weak applause. It's like, okay, well done. Smart trick. It won't matter because it won't come from a wound or an experience or something whereby it can offer an empathy. That is a richer intelligence. And a machine will be able to write something that will be like, absolutely, you know, wonderfully, all of that, it may read very well. It won't really matter. And that is what we think, I think we need to think. It has these certain sort of strict intelligences, but without that wider understanding of human experience and empathy with one another, okay. Well done. Nice trick. Let's move on.
Okay, so do keep the questions coming, and I'm going to invite my panelists to be equally brief if they can and when they answer them. So please put your hands up. We've got one at the front, but there's two here.
There's one at the back.
Oh, right at the back. Sorry, yes, go for it.
So to slightly follow up a bit on that question, I'd like to ask, how do we promote in our practices, in our work, human, distinctively human forms of reason in what we do? Because the state capitalist complex is transformed and is transforming how we do work in our schools, in our hospitals, in our universities, to make it very data-driven, clipboards, easily analyzable in, I mean, what would be called an instrumental reason, but something detached where it's not about communing with something complex and difficult. It's about easily analyzable, controllable information. And how do we go back, kind of like the arts and crafts movement, how do we go back to distinctively human forms of practice that cannot be replicated by artificial intelligence?
I think the way forward is the thing we've been talking about, which is about being critical and about being questioning. I used to get myself in an awful lot of trouble at university because I asked too many questions and they were too difficult and they were designed to disrupt. And I think we need to be more disruptive in our stance. I also think we need to talk to each other. There are lots of jokes that go around where, you know, when the system goes down, everybody meets and talks at the photocopier, which is still not working. But it's the whole idea that we talk to each other. So critical questioning and talking to each other, I think, are absolutely key.
I come in this. Yeah, I think that's absolutely, absolutely right. And I think we actually need to celebrate our imperfections, that AI can make you the perfect friend in a chatbot form that will say exactly what you want to hear, or the perfect girlfriend or boyfriend in some instances as well. But that perfection is inaccurate. Human friendships and relationships aren't like that. We have tension points, we have disagreements, we have embodied moments that AI will never have. And if we focus on the value of our imperfections, then the false perfection of AI becomes only more obvious.
And just to give an example from education, you know, my more recent experience as a teacher, it was very possible for me to use AI to generate a set of questions for the students, to use AI to answer those set of questions, and for me to then use AI to mark those set of questions. And in that process, there was no learning happening at all. Mm. There was a lot of data generated, which was helpful to be able to kind of, you know, tick a few boxes. We've got to change the value system for those things, and that's an economic question. It's a question of policy and education in order to get back to that human experience, and destroying and disrupting those kind of systems of value is extremely important.
Next question, please.
Thank you so much. I was really interested in what you were saying about us being a distributed network of Christ's love. I've thought a lot about the distributed network that AI might be, and how the financial crash of 2009 may have actually been the singularity point, the point at which we fed our children's futures to the machine in order to keep the machine alive rather than keep ourselves alive. And I wonder if one of the reasons why we lack critical thinking in this country around AI is because of the dominant frames of monotheism, that actually the distributed network that we may understand more fully through looking at something like mycelium, or looking at the intelligence that is contained in cobalt, in lithium, in the actual materials that AI is made from, and perhaps drawing on a panentheistic model, which is closer to a pantheistic model than a monotheistic model, might lead us to a critical thinking that can support us in our time. Perhaps it's the actual framing. Perhaps monotheism is the reason why we can't understand this monolith.
Oh, interesting.
Great question. Thank you. I guess all three of our panelists want to respond to that, but briefly.
There are many people thinking in similar directions who you might loosely call AI new religious movements or spiritual organizations that see AI as part of, I think you used the word Novocene from Lovelock, reinterpretations of the new sphere, that we're getting towards the Omega point that T.R. Jashadan talked about. But yeah, absolutely, there are people who interpret this moment as significant in the human evolution of civilization and where we're going next. And you might not agree with that, but that is another perspective on the non-human intelligences around us. And bringing AI into that cosmology of beings and potential beings is something that a lot of people are very keen on. And yes, you can loosely bound them and say they're AI new religious movements.
Great, thank you. Kester and Maggie, anything?
I think that's a wonderful kind of projection of things, but I I would say I would push it beyond that, that what I was talking about in radical theological idea is that it seeks to destroy all of these huge interpretations that come up. So even as that comes up as, oh, well, actually, we're looking at this, I would say, no, critique that, bring that down, bring that back down to understanding one another at that networked kind of distributed level, rather than saying there is a new meta-narrative which is higher than the old meta-narrative, because the thing about gods is that they keep getting resurrected. It is something key within us that, you know, we keep doing that work because we don't want to take responsibility individually as people. We prefer to project it onto another power, a higher power, that will take away that response for us. And it's incredibly important that we begin to take responsibility as humans for, you know, those around us and for our future and kind of generating that.
Do you want to say anything,
Maggie? No.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question.
So really want to say, really thank, we see all of your incredible hands up in the air. We love that we're sparking so many conversations. Please have these conversations after the session. Yeah. But this will be our final question for today. Thank you.
Should we be working to cultivate a culture which is prejudicially hostile towards AI, say rejecting AI-generated images as book covers because they're AI, walking out of church sermons that used AI because we're denigrating AI because of a threat that it is to us? Should we be working to cultivate that culture that is so negative towards AI?
Thank you very much. Great question.
I think radical dissent is the way forward. I'm not sure walking out of things is going to help. I think what we need to do is to do it critically in the way that Beth did with the images she was talking about. So I think it's back to the question before. I think it's about how critical are we? How do we encourage our children and young people to question and to discuss and debate? And so that if we want radical dissent, we need to be prepared to ask difficult questions.
So some people do propose that we go as far into rejection as possible. Elizia Yudikowsky is a significant voice in the existential risk discussion of AI, and he suggests that we should be prepared to blow up servers on which AI is being developed, and AGI might appear and destroy us all, because he's very much into the dystopian apocalyptic scenario. I don't want to go quite that far. I think we can make personal choices about what we use and don't use to a certain degree, and at a larger scale, make governmental decisions about how far we go with more uncontrollable forms of AI. But there is certainly that narrative that there is the only way to deal with this is just not to have it at all, just to not allow it.
And I think that would be a massive, massive mistake to think about the kind of recent thing to do with Thatcherism. You know, was it right that the coal mines closed? Yes, because we don't want that fossil fuel future. Was the way that it happened right? Absolutely not, because there was no thought for the way in which people need to think about their future of work, think about their dignity, their craft, their skills. We can't be rejecting technology. We've just got to be better humans and better to one another and think more carefully about our future of work. AI is absolutely one of the most wonderful acts of human creativity. Rejection is completely bonkers. We might as well reject having washing machines or clothes. You know, where do you stop rejecting technology if you start to go backwards? What we have to do is do better about thinking about how do technologies impact one another and how do we create a better future, embracing technology, but being pro-human and sustaining human flourishing through this just transition.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that wonderful last question. And I guess you might want to carry on the conversation with Kester after this. Thank you very much for a great event. Thank you for engaging with your interesting questions. I'm so sorry that we didn't have a chance to hear them all. My final thought is, I think based on the question here on my right, is Durkheim's theory that as old gods die, new gods emerge to take their place. I mean, I think we're entering a whole new, interesting spiritual, theological, as well as political and economic paradigm, which is full of danger, but as we've heard, full of hope. But the hope relies on us exercising our agency as human beings and in this particular context, human beings of faith. Can I just invite you to thank yourselves, but also to thank our panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the William Temple Foundation, to Chris for facilitating, and for Beth, Maggie and Kester as our panellists. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.